Welcome, everybody. Thanks for joining us once again for the 63rd Chat Show. Tonight, I've got Alistair Greenall with me, and I'm delighted that he's joined us because Alistair has a very varied career that we're itching to know about and itching to learn some tips from. So welcome, Alistair. Fabulous to have you with us. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks very much, Derek. No, great to be here. And we'll try and keep this to a reasonable length. But as you know from our briefing call, I could talk for many hours on subjects.
Yeah, I won't let you. Don't worry about that. But I've got a long list of things from our rehearsal that I want to ask you, because being on the Queen Mary II, 16 cruise boats, 3 billion miles, did you say, or million miles? Million miles,
it must not quite 3 billion. I'm not quite that old, no.
Well, you know, some of us presenters exaggerate a bit because it always it kind of helps, but that's probably too many. But Alistair, tell us a little bit about the cruise business at the moment. One of the questions I've been sent in is people are asking what's actually happening with the cruise liners, because I see a lot of ships parked off of Bournemouth and Weymouth at the moment.
Yeah, it's a very, very tough time for the industry without question. And the reality is that there's a huge amount of uncertainty for the protocols to exist, for them to be able to come back into business. It's going to be incredibly difficult and stringent. Although one line has already started, MSC cruises have started, and one or two of them are sort of dipping their toes in the water, excuse the pun there. And the reality is that it's going to be quite some time. The way that the model works for cruise ships these days, it's about packing them full of people and then making sure they're all participating, they're all spending money when they get on board. And there's a very tight model that they've created until such time as the industry is, you know, getting back on its feet. They're going to really, really struggle. And as we were saying before, they are now under a huge amount of financing just to keep going. Cunard, the last company I worked for, just announced recently that pretty well into next year now for any of their cruises to resume.
Yeah, that's really interesting. How are they going to get round the COVID? Because when I've been on cruises, you have to wash your hands every 5 minutes. You have to put them under the sanitizer, etc. And that was just for the normal issues on a cruise boat. Yeah, that's really interesting. What's your take on that?
Well, you know, obviously I'm slightly biased, but the industry has always had an incredibly high standard of hygiene, certainly in the last 20, 30 years. And they've always been ahead of the game. You know, I was on board when the SARS virus all happened. I was on board when the norovirus started first hitting, and all sorts of protocols are brought in. There's a few things that they are doing already. They've got loads of protocols about cleaning, about making sure that people don't use the same tongs in the buffet, all those kind of things. So they're always very, very ahead of the game when it comes to the various protocols. The big difference between this and any other virus or anything else that's gone beforehand is the length of the incubation period. You know, we're hearing today from Grant Shapps about people coming back and the whole discussion about having heat sensors at airports. Well, the trouble is, with an incubation period of 14 days, it's purely window dressing. You're not really achieving an awful lot apart from catching a few people who might be there and then infected. But given this huge length of time, it's really, really difficult. And until there's a vaccine, I think there's a very good chance that, and this is just me speaking, it's just my own personal opinion, I think it's going to get to the point where there's a vaccine, and it's going to be a little bit like, if you want to go to some countries, you have to have a smallpox vaccine to be able to get off the ship, like in South America and things. Or you need a yellow fever vaccine, or you need some of these vaccines to go to places. And I have a feeling the time will come on ships that's what they'll have to do to protect their other passengers and crew.
Sure. Okay. Well, let's move on to a more cheerful subject. I know you've sailed around the world so many times. What's your three favourite ports and why?
I do have three favorites. I mean, there's so many great ports to go to. I would say probably my number three is Sydney. You just cannot beat coming around. If anybody's ever, has anybody ever sailed into Sydney on a ship before? It's just the amazing thing if you just come through the what are called the heads, and it's actually quite a narrow inlet. In fact, so much so that James Cook, when he went there, actually missed it, and they went further up the coast to Botany Bay, and they only discovered the Sydney Harbour when they went out looking for water. And you just go in and you don't think it's anything there particularly, and you go in further, and then all of a sudden Sydney reveals itself in front of you, and it's just absolutely stunning. A best way to see Sydney, you've got, as you come in, you've got Manly on the starboard side, you eventually see Governor's Island, and then you go a little bit further and you then see the bridge just suddenly appears, and then the Opera House. Although, having said that, if you are staying at the Hyatt on the Rocks, which is right there by Circular Quay, make sure you book it when there aren't any cruise ships due, because you might have this beautiful balcony view looking at the Sydney Harbour Bridge to only find that this big floating block of flats comes right in front and blocks the view completely. So you have to be a little bit careful of that one.
That's a good tip. You wouldn't want that, would you? I've had that somewhere else. You've been on a cruise boat and you've got the docks instead of the sea. Okay, number two.
Number two's got to be New York. There's no question, you know, and especially being on a Cunard ship, you know, this whole thing of sailing across the Atlantic, you've been at sea for 6-7 days, and then you feel like almost in the wake of the pioneers who came in again under the Verrazano Bridge, and that amazing feeling of reaching there. And the first thing you see really of land is, after the Verrazano Bridge, is then the Statue of Liberty coming up close. And if you're on the bridge of Queen Mary too, literally her eyes are level with your eyes on the bridge, which is just amazing.
You were the cruise director, not the captain of the ship, weren't you?
No, I know, but I managed to convince them that if I do a commentary as we come in, can I come up on the bridge, please?
And negotiating skills, Alistair.
Exactly.
Reading my book again.
And I hadn't even read your book at that stage, Derek. But was that, how many more plugs do I need to get in for it before the end? I forget how many we agreed.
About seven, I think. Fabulous. Didn't you tell me that there was a problem when one of the ships came in? I don't know if you were on it, didn't you?
I wasn't on it at the time, but and actually it's really funny because people say these big new ships, you know, they must be really difficult to manoeuvre. And actually the irony is they're done with a little joystick now. They're incredibly easy. They have bow thrusters, stern thrusters. They have all sorts of mechanisms to help them. But poor old QE2, who I did sail on about 3 contracts before they sold her, nothing to do with me, I might add. And she was once coming into New York, and it's very tight, and the currents are very strong up and down the Hudson. So QE2 always had help with tugs, pulling, pushing, and all that kind of stuff. And on this particular day, as she was coming into her berth, there was a Japanese warship there. So it was a really, really tight squeeze. But Paul Wright, who was the captain, who became a great friend of mine, fellow Cornishman, so good breeding. And he was steering, bringing the ship in. And unfortunately, the currents were so strong that the ropes that they had holding onto the tugs broke. And QE2 was getting perilously close to this Japanese warship. More tugs came in, pushing, pulling, doing everything. And they just pulled her away from the Japanese warship, but not before she had just nicked a tiny little bit out of the Japanese warship. So, being the gallant captain, of course, Paul Wright sent his deputy captain over to explain it to the Japanese, and then suddenly thought, yeah, maybe I better go myself. So he got to the bottom of the gangway, and the Japanese commodore is at the top of the gangway waiting for him, you know, loads and loads of scrambled egg on his epaulettes. So sheepishly, Paul Wright goes to the top of the gangway and starts to explain the tragedy of the ropes breaking and the currents and how difficult it was, to which the Japanese commodore just stood there and eventually said, please, please, it's an honour for us to be kissed by a queen. It's a lovely story.
Wow, that's brilliant. Number one.
Number one is very controversial because there's a huge amount of people who are very anti-cruise ships going in to Venice. And I get it. If you're in St. Mark's Square, you're enjoying looking across the lagoon and you're seeing all of the great sights, and then this block of flats comes past. And I kind of get that. But I was on a brand new ship. We were back in the early days in the sort of mid-90s, mid to late 90s. Very few cruise ships were going in and out. And I was on a brand new ship with a chap called Bernie Warner, who eventually became a Commodore on Cunard, where we sailed with each other again. And I had this idea that I said, you know, Captain, it would be fantastic if for our maiden voyage to Venice, that as we come out of Venice, we play some Andrea Bocelli music and we get the atmosphere going on decks. And I said, what we'll do is if we come right alongside St. Mark's, how about I come on the tannoy and say, you know, how about we salute Venice, say thank you for welcoming us on our first visit to your wonderful city. I'll give a countdown, 3, 2, 1, blast the ship's whistles, and then we'll play Andrea Bocelli, Time to Say Goodbye. To which he said, and he genuinely spoke like this. He said, Master, you're the cruise director. You know about entertainment. I leave it to you. Fantastic. So I'm on the radio. I've got the broadcast center ready with the two CDs to swap the CDs when we get to that point. So we're literally just coming up to St. Mark's Square. So I radio the broadcasting center. Okay, switch CDs. Just listen in for my announcement. Okay, everybody on the decks, let's say a big thank you to everybody in Venice for welcoming us on our maiden voyage to this fine city with a countdown from all of you. So here we go, 3, 2, 1. At which point the officer of the watch went, well, they don't actually do that. They just push a button now, actually, but play the music. The music plays fantastic. I go on the open decks and genuinely hardly a dry eye. It was just incredibly emotional. That beautiful music with the vista of Venice sailing past and everything. About 5 to 10 minutes later, my pager goes off. Cruise director reports the bridge immediately. Not the kind of message you really want to get, and not in that tone. So I rather sheepishly went off up to the bridge, and the captain was there with the pilot. And he said, now, sir, I've just had the mayor of Venice on the UHF radio. Apparently, it's illegal to blast the ship's whistles in Venice. The pigeons don't like it. And needless to say, we've talked about it many times since. People apparently didn't like the extra garnishes they got on their pizzas sat in St. Mark's Square when the pigeons got upset. So anyway, so that was the end of that.
That is an absolutely brilliant story. You talked your way out of that one, did you? That was just one of those stories to forget. Now, you were telling me one or two other things that go on cruise ships, and you were telling me that drugs tests usually get taken in Barcelona. Is that something you can share, or should we leave that till later?
Yeah, no, I think we can share. Basically, one of the things that people don't realise is that yes, a lot goes on behind the scenes and so on, and every generation of people who work on ships say, oh, it wasn't like the old days. It's the same for everybody in every industry, right? It's not like the old days.
Absolutely.
And there's no question it's become a lot more tame. The days of things like the captain being so drunk his head falls into the soup at dinner, and by the way, I do have it on very good authority that did actually happen once. A social hostess I worked with actually witnessed it and then escorted the captain out and said, oh, he's not feeling terribly well, and then escorted him back to his cabin. But those days have well and truly gone. And the crew now as well, the zero tolerance to drunkenness, zero tolerance to any drugs, anything like that. People are pretty clean living. There's lots of, friendships between the crew still happen, but not between the crew and passengers. Again, a bit of a blind eye was turned towards that when I started off at sea in the early 90s. But by the sort of mid 90s, that had all gone. It was all over. It was all very clean living. But we would have drug tests, and I don't know why, but Barcelona was a pretty favourite port. And what they would do is they would basically come on board. It was a private company. They'd come on board, and then I'd get a phone call from my boss, who was the hotel director, and he'd say, cruise director, drug test day, come get your list. And I'd have to go down to his office. I'd pick up the list of my department, and out of 120 people, there'd probably be about 25 odd people that would need a test. What other department heads would do is call their managers and say, come and get your list. And then it would filter on down to all the assistant managers, and eventually they would have to go and phone them around. Well, being the decent manager I was, I used to phone them around. I thought, what the heck, I'm up anyway. You know, you try getting musicians up at that time of the morning, you know, it's not going to happen. So I'd pick up the phone. But the trouble was, I'd be phoning up one cabin and say, okay, so who is it? Oh, Valerie Robertson. Okay, Valerie, she's in 5226, 5526. Hi, yeah, sorry to call you. It's Alistair Cruise Director. Is Valerie there, please? Oh, is she? Oh, okay, sorry. No, I didn't realise. So who did you say she's seeing now? Oh, George. Oh, the drummer in the theatre orchestra. Yeah, I know. Yeah, okay, no problem. Phone down. George Orchestra. Okay, 6127. Okay, 6127. Hi, yeah, it's Alistair Cruise Director. Sorry to bother you so early. I understand Valerie is there with George. Oh, she's not seeing George anymore. Who's she seeing now? Oh, the guitarist in the trio. Okay, and literally you'd be trying to find people, none of them in their own flipping cabins. They're all over the place. And then there was a little bit of a rumour that one or two people also had little samples in their fridges that people could buy to make sure that they were had a clean sample, should we say. I couldn't say anything particularly about that, but it was a rumour that went round.
Of course, and that would be very unprofessional for you to say anything like that. So we.
I would not mention Gordon Sinclair, the drummer in the other orchestra. No, I wouldn't mention him at all.
We won't drill down anymore. You were telling me another story. By the way, you're a fantastic storyteller, Alistair. Brilliant, and it just shows the power of stories on learning points. And the one learning point I took away from there that we can all take away from, and the people looking at this on YouTube, is that personal touch of you ringing everybody personally rather than delegating it down. And so many times those things get delegated down, and that's absolutely fabulous. Did you told me a story about an Italian guy throwing his toys out the pram with the band or one of the girls or something and hitting the girl on the head, but did it bounce off of a passenger or something?
Well, unfortunately, you know, musicians, anybody who knows musicians knows that they have an interesting temperament. And in fairness, I always had tremendous respect for musicians. I'd be standing in the wings of an orchestra or watching them doing a jazz set, and I would always be in awe of their talent and what they could do. But of course, they are unique individuals. And for a musical director to have that business hat on, but also the creative hat of being a fantastic musician, because obviously he's going to walk the walk. And I hadn't actually been in the big chair. I hadn't been the cruise director for long. I'd been at sea for maybe 3 years and had got to the dizzy heights of the head of department. And I hadn't really been in the job, I think maybe about 3 months, something like that. And we had one particular trouble with this one trio who played in one of the lounges. And they were called the Ludwig Steuken Trio. That rolls off the tongue beautifully, doesn't it?
Fabulous.
And yeah. And anyway, Ludwig, who was the leader of the band, he hired Helga to be the guest, his singer. And I'm not sure, entirely sure what the arrangement was. We were led to believe by her that it was a platonic relationship. She was just the singer. I think Ludwig had other ideas, and he didn't like it when she would just be schmoozing the passengers or anybody else, as you do as the singer fronting the band. Anyway, on this particular occasion, it didn't go terribly well. And I had the musical director came into my office and said, Cruise Director, you need to know, he was an Italian. That's why I'm speaking the Polish accent. He'd say, Cruise Director, we had a problem last night with Ludwig. He excelled himself. I said, oh dear, what did he do? Well, Helga was looking at one of the passengers, and Ludwig did not like it very much, so he grabbed the stool she was sat on and threw it at her. Unfortunately, it ricocheted off her leg and hit a passenger. And at that point, I turned to Paolo and said, well, it's chicken or beef, isn't it, Paolo? Now, this was a phrase we used in our industry. Chicken or beef basically meant they were going home, because that's what they'd be offered on the airline on the way home. So it was just a nickname we had. It was either Greener Airways or chicken or beef. It was one or the other.
Fantastic. Now, tell us all about Lulu. You were you were so enthralled by having Lulu on the ship that you fell off the stage. Is that right?
Well, yeah, and I should also correct this. One or two of you might know somebody called Michael Dodd, a colleague of ours at the PSA. And I should actually mention, nobody knew I fell off the stage. That's really important. As a true pro, I managed to cover it. And basically, everybody knows, as a true professional, you walk on and off the stage, you go through it before you go walk on and off. And I wasn't a brand new ship. This was our maiden voyage, and Lulu was coming on in Madeira, and she was performing that big night, the big, big show. And obviously I knew the stage. I'd walked on and off it a few times, although it was new. But this particular ship, it had the proscenium arch, and they're beautiful, beautiful theatres on ships these days. And there's a bit between the proscenium arch, which is the main arch, and then there's a gap where the curtains go as they open. And I was introducing Lulu and thinking that, okay, so I'll go off on the stage right as a true professional. She's coming on stage left, everything's fine. So I say, ladies and gentlemen, Lulu, and walk off the side. Well, my angle wasn't quite right. I should have been heading kind of like that direction to get into the wings. And I went that direction. So unfortunately, I ended up where the curtains are. The problem is that's all that's there is the curtains and a 3-foot drop and nothing else. So I walk off. Fortunately, my microphone had been muted by the booth, so you didn't hear the thud as I crashed to the ground. But the problem was, I was stuck there. I couldn't get out because I'd have to go back on stage, and you can hardly say, sorry, Lulu, you carry on. I'm just going to go, right? You can't really do that. So I thought, what can I do? I'll just stay there. Now, here was a good lesson that I had learned many years before. Always have a very clear briefing with your tech guys so they know exactly what you're doing and so on. And I was running between lots of different things on the ship and so on. So they would always keep my microphone ready on muted. I would keep it live, it would always be ready, fine. I'm stuck there, they're paging me. I can't answer them, I can't, you know, they just have to assume I'm there. Well, I am in that pit in pitch black for an hour and a half. I eventually hear the show ending and I'm saying off stage, as a true MC would do, ladies and gentlemen, Lulu. So the tech guys up at the booth knew I was there, had no idea where, because the support guys behind the stage had no idea, they didn't see me. So I did all that. But of course, then I walk out on stage completely blinded by the lights. I can hardly see a thing. Fortunately, I didn't bump into her. Fortunately, everything was fine. She was performing with Kiki D. It was a cracking show, and I had a brilliant seat. Well, I was leaning like this, actually, looking on my little plinth to the side. So nobody actually knew. I didn't think even Lulu knew. I certainly wasn't going to mention to her. Nobody knew until a little while later when I eventually fronted up that I had actually fallen off the side of the stage. Fantastic. But not too many scratches.
What a brilliant story. Let's turn to your TV presenting now. You told me that you did 40 programs in Dallas for a TV company called The Genesis of Healing. That sounds very interesting.
Yeah, I'm a great believer in serendipity. I'm a great believer in you just got to be doing something to get more work and something. And that goes with what I'm doing now in my communications training and speaking and so on. And it was one of those things, I'm terrible, I just say yes. And I had been doing, because I'd done some TV presenting before I went on to ships for a few years, and they were looking for someone to front the training videos. And I said, yep, you know, put my hand up, said, yeah, I'll do that. And in this particular year, it was fantastic. I was going to the different ships, I was going to different companies within the corporation, I was going to Australia, I was going all over the place making these videos, and it was brilliant. Anyway, the production company, I got a call when I was on leave back home one time. They said, we've got an inquiry, they're looking for a white male British TV host for this show about health and stuff. You know, are you up for it? And I said, yep. And they said, we don't know anything about it. I said, no, I'm up for it. Where do I sign? And next thing, I was on a flight to Dallas, meeting with the producers and everybody. And we agreed terms and it was great. And literally they would film in between me taking leave. And I'll make a little bit of admission here. This was a number of years ago. I would leave the ship. And because I was on what they call a seafarer's visa, I had to leave the country as a seafarer and then come back in the country on a different visa, on a working visa. So literally I had to go out and I'd take a little flight off to the Bahamas and back, or up to Toronto and back, and then come back in and then go off to Dallas. And this went on for about two, three years, I think it was in the end. But we had so much fun. We filmed this series everywhere apart from in Dallas. I think all we did in Dallas was the voiceovers. And the rest we filmed in India, in China, in Europe, and all over the place. And we had an absolute blast. It was great. Apart from absolutely freezing to death on the Great Wall of China. You know, I'd love to say it was a wonderful experience. I remember, all I remember is being absolutely frozen with my teeth chattering and trying to make sure I got my lines right, because I wasn't going to be able to put on a jacket until I got my lines right.
Gee whiz, amazing. And you do some TV presenting now in the UK and all over the world, and you do some voiceovers as well. You run communication programs and presentation coaching.
Yeah,
Tell us a little bit about that.
About 10 years ago, I decided that, it was about time to grow up and get a normal job. So having spent 16 years for three companies on 14 ships and traveled 3 million nautical miles, I thought, yeah, that's fine. I'm ready to move on. So the intention was just to go back to my TV presenting work, which is what I did. And I still do things. I've done everything from Shopping Channel. If anybody knows Bid TV, yeah, I did that, flogging stuff and, things, and you have to have them in your hand. And literally when you're looking at those cameras, you're seeing what the viewer's seeing. So when they're doing this, and this is the price and it's going down, you're looking at the screen so you can see exactly what's there. So I did all of that. I still do a thing called Business Reporter, where we interview leaders of industry and things. And then by accident, I got into after dinner speaking because people wanted to hear about my life on cruise ships and things. It started like so many things, like many people start their speaking career, talking to the WI and Probus clubs and people like that. And I thought, this is interesting. And I thought, well, I better learn how to do this professionally. What's the industry? And that's why I bumped into the PSA. And the PSA then gave me the idea to actually start leveraging my skills as a TV presenter to help other people present, whether it be on stage, whether it be on camera or in the media. And so I started developing that side of things. And I still do the voiceovers. But one of the things I got particularly passionate about over the last 3 years is personalized communication, making sure that people take some of the algorithms out of the way we communicate and actually communicate on a personal level and how effective that is. So between it all, I'm doing a lot of different things, but loving the variety. And not like some people think in my village, oh, you're off the ships now, you're retired, are you? No. I'm still working. And actually, I love the variety that I now have. It's brilliant.
Fantastic. That's absolutely brilliant. Well, I'm going to stop the recording in a minute and throw the questions open to all our guests. But before I do that, I just want to summarize a couple of tips I picked up from you. Number one is the preparation with the AV team, etc., going through everything. Number two is your personal communication with the crew, with 120 people that work for you. That's a staggering number of people to be responsible for, and also your communication with the captain. And I like your accents and your sense of humour. One last tip for everybody, Alistair, unrehearsed.
Yeah, I would say I'm big into relationship building, and obviously there's a very good friend of ours, Will Kintish, on the call tonight as well. And Will and I have talked at length about relationship building, especially when Will talks about networking. And Will and I have worked together where basically you take a relationship that you might have, then it's building and nurturing that relationship. I hate to use the cliche about a plant that you get from the supermarket, it's all great, but you've got to keep looking after it. And I feel relationships are the same. And just sending out newsletters, nothing wrong with them, but you have to nurture, you have to have a personal contact with people to keep that relationship going. And that's something that I'm particularly keen on, and I help businesses, individuals and organizations to reintroduce that personal touch, whether it's a personal thank you card, whether it's a phone call, whether it's just a personalized email rather than just the stock email. That kind of level of communication is the way that you build trust and build better relationships.
Fantastic, Alistair. Thanks for joining us today. And I would say if anyone's watching this or listening to this, please Google Alistair to Alistair Greener to find his address, to contact him. And if you're watching the series on YouTube or the series on the podcasts, please like them. If you've got any questions or queries, give me a ring or email me at Derek Arden, www.derekarden.co.uk, and I look forward to seeing you on the next show. Big thank you to Alistair, everybody. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much, dear, for having me, Derek, and thanks everyone else for being on the call. It's been fun. Thank you.